Today's Taisho will be on Case 41 in the Mumonkan. Case 41 is entitled Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing a wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind. Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shisanro did not know four ideographs. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma, and the trouble arose. The clamor of monasteries is all because of you." So this story involves the great Indian monk Bodhidharma. At our sesshin this time, we had an interesting man who came from a state in India called Orissa, and he had sat with our group about maybe a year ago. He came here on a Saturday and was very impressed by our practice. And about 2 months before our sesshin, I got an email from him, and he said, "I would like to come to your Zen camp." So I said, "Well, you know, you're most welcome." But, I didn't really think he would show up. But he wrote me a few weeks before the sesshin, and he said, "I've booked my tickets. And I'm on the way." And this person, whose name was Varish, was really a remarkable man. He was 69 years old, which I didn't know when he wrote me the email. I think I might have tried to discourage him. But he in his emails, he was very lively and seemed tremendously enthusiastic. And really, I just didn't think he was going to show up. But he wrote me a few weeks before sesshin, and then he arrived, and I picked him up at the Holiday Inn in Piscataway, and he stayed at our house for a little while before the sesshin. And he was an amazing person. He sat every sit, every one of our sits he participated in. So if you know anything about our sesshin practice, we have periods in the afternoon that are really optional, and actually a period in the evening that's optional. So after lunch, there's a 2:30 sit, and then between the 3:30 and 4:30, there's a shower period. And very often he came to that sit, and also he was sometimes at the evening sit. But he never missed any of the regular sits, and I was just amazed. And he would come into Dokusan. This was the first sesshin he had ever done, and I expected once I realized how old he was that he might need to sit in a chair or he might need to get extra rest. I thought perhaps he would be spending time in his room, but he never missed a sit. And when he would come into Dokusan, I would say, "Well, how are you doing?" And I thought he was going to tell me the usual first machine stories of legs that are hurting and tired. And he said, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. If I were superstitious, I would think that maybe he wasn't a normal human being. You know, in Chinese Zen, there are stories about Zen masters who get lost in the mountains. In fact, the historically accurate, the historically real Zen master Xu Yun, who died in 1958, actually supposed to have gotten lost in the mountains and met a mysterious stranger who guided him out of the mountains at a time when he might have died of exposure. And, you know, it's commonly believed that this was Bodhisattva, you know, basically, who made a special appearance. If I didn't know better, being a modern person, I have that, I don't believe in unusual events like that. But if I didn't know better, I would think this guy was some kind of bodhisattva, you know, spying on our sangha. But actually, he was a human being, I'm happy to say. But a remarkable one. And he did just a brilliant job with Sesshin, and he would come in, and I thought he was going to go, oh, sir, I'm so, my leg. And he said, this is wonderful, this is wonderful. Well, you know, interestingly, some people think that Bodhidharma could have come from Orissa. There's quite a debate about where he came from, but it's quite possible that he did come from Orissa. And Mahayana, the Mahayana movement in Zen, may also come from Orissa. It was a big center for Buddhist activity for a long time, more than 1,000 years. And Bodhidharma could have come from there. You know, when Bodhidharma was quite an accomplished meditation master in a tradition of meditation known as jhana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. And jhana meditation is a kind of meditation where you go into deep samadhi and then basically you unify yourself with what is happening around you. And so Bodhidharma was quite accomplished at this, and he taught probably associated with eventually Nalanda University in India. But at any rate, he came to China when he was in his 40s, and he brought Zen to China. In China, what the Indians called jhana became chan. And when the Japanese heard the word chan, they said zen. There's no Z sound in Chinese, and there's no CH sound in Japanese. So everybody's done his best, right? trying to pronounce these words. So Dhammo, Bodhidharma, came to China. And apparently the story is that he was asked to meet the Emperor Wu of Liang. And at this time, Buddhism was already quite well established, was already quite well established in that part of China. And Emperor Wu was building temples all over the place and libraries and academic study centers and so on. And he had been told that this great meditation master from China, from India, was coming to China, and that this was his opportunity to meet the great Bodhidharma. And there are a number of koans that involve these events, this string or this chain of events. And basically, Bodhidharma met with the Emperor of China, and it was a disaster. You know, so if you think about it, Zen begins with a disaster. The emperor called in Bodhidharma, and he said to Bodhidharma, you know, I have built all of these temples and all of these libraries and all of these monasteries, stupas. You know, I'd like you to tell me, you know, what kind of merit I have achieved. And In Buddhism, there is this concept of dana, or giving. And many people think that if you give, you get, right? So basically, all over Southeast Asia, you'll see monks with their begging bowls, and people put food wrapped in banana leaves in their bowls, or they put money in their bowls. And many people believe that by giving dana to monks or nuns, you're improving your karma. This is not really a Mahayana view, by the way, but it's the way many people think. So, people give alms to monks, and the emperor was giving alms to the Sangha, and he said to Bodhidharma, how much merit have I got? And Bodhidharma was, he could have been obsequious, and he could have said, well, I don't know how much, Your Majesty, but I'm sure, your next rebirth will be auspicious, or something like that. But Bodhidharma just said, there's no such thing as merit. And the emperor was shocked, and he said, but, if you don't teach, getting rid of your sins through doing good deeds and purifying your mind and so on, what do you teach? And Bodhidharma said, I teach vast emptiness, vast emptiness. So the emperor was totally flummoxed. He had no idea what vast emptiness had to do with Buddhism or with what he was doing as a sponsor of the Dharma. And it was like a non-event. After a while, they're just sitting there in silence, And finally, Bodhidharma, took his leave and left. And according to the legend, there was a monk at the court during this whole interview. There was a Buddhist monk who saw this exchange. And after Bodhidharma had left, the emperor turned to him and said, "Who was that?" And the monk said, that was the Bodhisattva of Enlightenment. That was Avalokiteshvara, or Guan Yin. That was an embodiment of the highest compassion, you could say, the highest compassion. The emperor said, "Well, quick, go get him." And the monk said, "Listen, I have the feeling that if you try to stop him, he'll never come back. I think it's over." So Bodhidharma went up into the mountains near what is now Shaolin Monastery, he just went and lived in this cave, and local people, maybe brought food for him. And he meditated for 9 years facing the wall of this cave. And in Chinese, this is called pi kuan, wall staring. When we sit down on the cushion and we follow the breath until we enter deep samadhi, and then we practice wuxin, we practice mu, our mind becomes blank like a wall. It's like facing a wall. So sometimes the method of Zen is said to be pi kuan, wall staring. And in some Zen communities, people actually stare at a wall. In Soto Zen in Japan, it's quite common for people to sit facing the wall. In our tradition, we sit facing each other, but we're still doing wall staring. Wall staring is not about staring at a wall. It's about going to that place inside yourself that's blank and empty, and then coming up to that surface, which is really like the door to your unconscious mind, and waiting for the unconscious mind to activate, or to activate you. In this case, after Bodhidharma left the emperor and went up into the mountains, he just sat for 9 years waiting for somebody to show up. All of this is I think is just a wonderful story that people have in the Zen world have internalized for many generations. And even if people don't get anything else out of the story except sort of like lesson for living, I think it's really a wonderful lesson for living. Today we things did not go as planned, right? Sometime in the middle of the first session of meditation, the first three sits, the power went off, and who knows why, right? Somewhere on this campus, or somewhere somebody cut a wire, or they turned something off, or we really don't know. But something happened, and now it's no longer our normal procedure. So we can't turn on the lights and recite the sutras, and we can't. When people came in, there was no. It was hot. It's hot. It was a little cooler in here actually, but a little while ago, the air was sort of close and still and hot. And people, when we came in out of the sun, we had to pick our way very carefully, very gingerly. And it's, I was sitting here and listening. I often listen to the sound of the blowers. I like that sound. And then they just stopped. And the electric candle went out, and everything went out. It was very still, very still. It was not what I'm used to, not what we're used to. And, people can react to things differently when they deviate from the norm, people can feel ill at ease. If you like that sound of the blower, sometimes that white noise allows people to have deeper sits, So, if you come to the sit on Saturday, it becomes a ritual, And you pretty much expect it to be the same experience every time. So you come in and the blower is going, you sit down, we sit for an hour or we sit for three sits and have a bathroom break. Then there's the Taisha and there's the Sutra Rest. It's all very familiar. But when things deviate from the norm, we can feel, maybe in this case it's pretty safe. Nobody's going to get hurt unless they fall over their cushion. But when things deviate from the norm, it can have an unnerving effect. It can have an unnerving effect. I was reading, yesterday was Friday the 13th, right? And we could say, well, this is all connected to Friday the 13th in some way. It's a day late, but whatever happened started yesterday or something. And it said one out of four people is, somewhat superstitious. And if you know anything about sports, sports people are highly superstitious. So, if you hit the ball out of the park, you have the bases loaded and you get home, you hit the ball and everybody gets home. A lot of sports people try to repeat exactly that formula. So they think, oh my God, what did I do that day? I got up and I had an extra half cup of coffee, before I came to the stadium, I stamped my feet, my cleats. They try to remember and then they try to do that every time, right? So I rubbed my back with my handkerchief or with my glove, and they do it every time, trying to make that mojo come back. So this is very human, and we all get used to arrangements that are familiar. And there's something deeply reassuring. When things go awry, it's very interesting how disorienting it can be. Things can become very quickly dreamlike. Very quickly it becomes like a dream, I think it's interesting that, this can happen in many settings. If you're in a building and the lights go out, suddenly you're groping in the hallways blindly, or power has gone out in New York. Those sorts of things have actually happened. Sometimes you get this feeling when you've deviated very dramatically from normal that, it's like this is like a dream. Is this really happening? Everything becomes very dreamlike. I think that our sense of reality is really very closely tied to repetition. You know, so when new things happen, they have a kind of dreamlike quality sometimes. And when we repeat them, though, they begin to feel more real and more firm, you know. So, you know, this is a story about a great Zen master, a great meditation master, who has this opportunity to meet the Emperor of China. And things don't go as expected, you know. It's like a disaster. And Bodhidharma goes to this mountain, and goes to this mountain, and he finds a cave, and he lives in this cave for 9 years, facing a wall. You know, his mission is to bring Zen to China, and he could be out giving talks or writing books and giving lectures, but instead he's sitting in this cave waiting. And I think that's an interesting model for our lives, you know, because somehow when things don't go the way he planned, Bodhidharma isn't rocked by it, you know. He has a kind of stability, or he has an ability to ground himself in some way that we don't really understand, you know, at first in the story. This is disastrous encounter. He goes up, and instead of trying to spread Zen through various mechanisms, he just sits in a cave and waits for students to show up. Now, you know, if you were trying to start a business, or if you were trying to start a political movement, you know, nobody would give you very good odds if your method was to just sit in a cave and stare at the wall. And this could all be legendary. It could be. But, you know, there is a cave where Bodhidharma is supposed to have lived. And in fact, you know, both Chinese and Tibetan Buddhism are full of stories of really great masters who lived in caves for extended periods of time. Xu Yun lived in a hut. And actually his hut, somebody else is living there now. There's somebody else, some other monk is living there right now. It's occupied. So, you know, basically, Bodhidharma lives in this cave, and he's waiting for people to show up, and lo and behold, people show up. You know, three people eventually show up, two men and one woman. And these are the people who actually established Zen in China. This is how Zen got started, out of millions and millions of people who practice Zen, or Chan, all trace their lineage back to Bodhidharma and his three students. So this is the story of the first student, who's sometimes called Shinko in Japanese. And he is a scholar, somebody with a greatly well-developed intellect, very broad knowledge, and he can't find a way to ground himself, right? I mean, this is sort of the modern world. You know, we live with many, we're awash in information, and we're awash in ideas, right? And they're all very compelling. So, you know, when I started going to graduate school a long time ago, there was a very famous philosopher named Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre. And I love, even today, sometimes I will pull Sartre off the shelf and read him, and he's so exciting to me. I just love existentialism. And when I was an undergraduate, you know, existentialism was so hot, you know. If you wanted to be cool, you let people know you were an existentialist. if you wore blue jeans, a white shirt, and a leather jacket, you know, you looked like an existentialist, you know, basically. And for me, that whole scene just had so much freedom, and there were existentialist poetry and existentialist art, and you know, anyway. Existentialism had this wonderful moment, and then it sort of fell apart. You know, in America, it was attacked by various... Americans weren't comfortable with existentialism for many reasons, and a lot of American intellectuals attacked it. And in France, existentialism was attacked too by Marxists, you know, and they Sartre, my beloved Sartre, was involved in a televised debate with a very famous Marxist named Althusser. And apparently Althusser killed Sartre on television. He just made mincemeat out of it. So, you know, basically, existentialism sort of declined, and, you know, I held on for as long as I could, you know, but there were new philosophies, you know, and when I was a graduate student, there were new philosophies. There was post-structuralism, and there was a philosopher named Foucault, and everybody was reading Foucault. Nobody, you said, I've read Sartre, people looked at you like you were wearing yesterday's clothes, you know. So Foucault, he must read Foucault, Sartre is nowhere, Foucault, you know. So you read Foucault, and he's very compelling. You know, Sartre, when you read him, he's very compelling. And Foucault is very compelling, you know, very compelling. And then there was this other guy, Derrida, very compelling, you know. And by the way, you know, how compelling, Foucault is so compelling, you know, when I was in graduate school, you know, Monsieur Foucault used to shave his head. And he wore little granny glasses just to be even stranger. So you would see these photos of Foucault, the very big man, very tall man, and he was striking because his head was totally shaved, and he wore these granny glasses, and he had a slightly, you know, demented look. You know. So suddenly I would be walking around campus, and I would see graduate students with their heads shaved and granny glasses on. No, I kid you not, you know. I kid you not. Those people found Foucault very compelling, right? They found, you know, and by the way, I actually love Foucault myself. I've read almost every book he wrote, and I find him tremendously exciting. But, you know, he doesn't agree with Sartre, you know. And then Monsieur Derrida became very famous, and you know, it could go on and on. You know, it never stops. The thing that you know can be troubling about all of this is that when you read Foucault, you know, he's believable, and the more you read, the more believable he is. You know, but then when you read somebody else, Bourdieu, you know, you read Bourdieu, and he's so believable, but doesn't fit with Foucault. You know, and you can find yourself like. Where do I stand in all of this? Where do I stand in all of this? And, you know, people can become like true believers, right? True believers, you know. So I'm for Foucault. You know, I'm not going to change. You know, and but you know, the thing is, society moves on, and these thinkers become history. And you have to ask yourself, what does this all mean? You know, what does this all mean? And I don't think it's meaningless. But it does tell us something. You know, we create these worlds of ideas and imagination, and they become very compelling. They seem, from inside, they seem very real, and they're very useful in certain ways, you know. But I think in the modern world, we have so much of this, you know, that we begin to feel like we're floating, or how do we position ourselves, you know. And when things go really wrong, when things really start falling apart, I don't think we know what to do, you know? I mean, you know, I've read all of Foucault's books, you know, but I don't think that if I had a cancer diagnosis, it would be, I think they would suddenly seem very remote, you know? I have read a lot of books on death and dying, you know? But when I've actually dealt with people who are dying, you know, those books seem very remote. You know, the immediacy of the event was kind of like overwhelming for me, you know, overwhelming. So, you know, I took care of my father in his last days, and he was very sick with cancer. And it was really a very moving experience, but it really was difficult to handle emotionally. It was really overwhelming. And I took care of my father-in-law. He was dying. You know, so I've taken care of a number of people who are dying and who die. And it, you know, it really sort of like blows away your ideas. You know, and then it's hard to position. You know, where do I position myself? You know. So, So we live in a world of information, and I think lots of people have a hard time figuring out who they are. You know, I could be a Foucauldian, I could be a Derridian, I could do this, I could do this. Who are you really? You know, what does it mean to, you know, be you? You know, and how do you ground yourself in the world? And so much of our identity has to do with, like, trying to please others, trying to please others, you know. When I came to Rutgers, I was a junior faculty person, and the most powerful professor in the department was a guy named Richard Poirier. Richard Poirier was from New England, and he had this horrible, horrible New England accent. So when he would say modern, he would say modern. And it was like that accent is just, you know, what's the modern? You know, what is the modern? You might hear him say the modern. Now, I had no idea. Is that some soup up in Boston? The modern. And finally somebody says he's modern, and you see that's Poirier's accent, modern. But, you know, I would walk around the building and I would hear graduate students who weren't from, you know, the Back Bay in Massachusetts say, modern, the modern. They were just trying to be real, you know, they were just trying to be real, and they were taking their cue from Poirier, who seemed to be like the most real person they knew. You know, the most fully realized person. So I think this is our world. I think we try to be real by you know, being the way others want us to be, or we think the way others want us to be. And, you know, you can be in this reality or this reality or this reality or this reality or this reality. And I'm not saying they're false. You know, I'm not saying that people who like Foucault are phonies. I don't believe that. You know, I think Foucault has made an incredible contribution. I think he's a really brilliant guy, and I think he's given us a way to think about certain problems that's really valuable. So I'm not making fun of him. And I'm not making fun of Mr. Poirier or his graduate students who learned to say modern. You know, I'm trying to talk about how we live from day to day, you know, by getting into these systems or these dream worlds or these idea worlds and taking them for real until they begin to fall apart, because they all fall apart. You know, you're an existentialist and an existentialist and an existentialist, and one day, you know, your hero goes on TV and his whole philosophy is torn apart by some guy. And this happens. Or it can be something more dramatic, you know. Yesterday, I was reading, that the Pope said that he thought the world economy was on the edge of collapse. Now, you know, he may be totally wrong. You know, he's good at being a Pope. He's not an economist, you know. But, you know, he might be right. You know, and if the world economy collapses, it won't be the first time, right, you know, that it's happened. And what then? You know, how do you ground yourself? And, you know, the Zen view is that if you trust ideas, if you trust these beautiful dream worlds, you know, it's okay, but it's not the best way to go. You know, there's a deeper way to live, you know. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't read books, and I'm not saying you shouldn't learn everything you can learn. I'm not saying that, you know. I recommend Foucault highly, you know. I recommend, poetry and novels and painting. I love them all. But, you know, there's a kind of dreamlike quality to these, and that they are not necessarily real in the way we think. And when when things begin to fall apart, we don't necessarily know what to do. You know, when our heroes turn out to be not so great, or when our dream worlds fall apart, like when an economy falls apart, or when a political system falls apart, then what then? You know. So, you know, this koan is really about what then. The what then. Bodhidharma is, you know, this is his job interview. This is his big chance. You know, if it had gone well, he would have, you know, knocked the socks off of the Emperor of China. The guy would have built him a Zen institute, you know, in the mountains, and the best and the brightest would have gone there to study, and instead he winds up, you know, it winds up being a disaster. So, you know, he goes up and he practices Pequan, wall staring. You know, and this is our method in Zen. You know, when we feel the ground giving out from under us, when suddenly what seems so real begins to have this eerie, dreamlike quality of unreality, which is the sign that things are shifting, things are changing. You know, what do you do? I myself have lived through moments like this. You know, when I was a little boy, John Kennedy, you probably don't know about John Kennedy, but John Kennedy was president. And this was like the high point of the American empire, you know, actually. You know, Kennedy was this very youthful, incredibly sexy, handsome man. And my mother adored him. You know, he was an incredibly handsome man, and he was brilliant, you know. He would hold these press conferences. And at that moment, everything in America seemed to be going so well. You know, we had just come out of World War II, and we were the good guys in World War II. You know, the Germans were clearly the bad guys, you know, and we beat them, you know, and we did everything right. You know, we put Europe back on its feet. And there was all this architecture and art, poetry. You know, Kennedy was like an intellectual. You know, he liked jazz. You know, can you believe that? You know, and he liked existentialism. He invited a poet to read at his inauguration, which hadn't been done before. Now it's a standard. But he invited this poet, Robert Frost, to come and read. And, you know, Kennedy was like this hero for the whole country. And everything seemed to be going right for us, you know. And growing up in that world, it just seemed like, you know, it was like the perfect world for people of my generation. And then, you know, it all began to unravel. You know, so, you know, I think I was in the second grade, something like that. And, you know, I went to school, and then it said over the loudspeaker, the president has been shot. You know, it's like, what? You know? And then, you know, it was like, that was just the, you know, my mother cried for like a week, you know, she just couldn't get a hold of herself. And I think people were not just crying for Kennedy. It was like this dream world has beginning to unravel, you know, and then, you know, it was just like one thing after another. We had, suddenly there were all these riots in the United States that had already happened, but it was, riots were erupting across the country, and we got ensnared in Vietnam, and, you know, by the time I was in college, it was like a totally different country, and everything seemed to be falling. It was like the dream fell apart, you know, and this happens all the time, you know, to people, and it happens in our personal life too, you know. Everything's going beautifully. The other day, I was walking across the lawn in front of the building where I work. And I ran into a friend of mine who's an art professor. And I've known him for, you know, almost 30 years. And I noticed he had a big bandage on the back of his neck, which is, he had been having chemo, I could see. And I said, how are you? I said, oh my gosh. And he said, yes, you know. And I said, how are you doing? And he said, I'm going to make it. He said, but you know, he said, it's like being hit by a tidal wave, and it washes you around in the water. And when you come up to the surface, you look around to see what's left of your life. And, you know, that is so true, right? That is so true. You know, he's a very distinguished art historian. He is probably one of the most respected people in his field in the country. And, you know, and then he got cancer all of a sudden. And the next thing you know, this tidal wave sweeps him away, and he comes to the surface and looks around to see what's left. This is not, you know, we don't like to imagine that life has this character, and we shouldn't live in dread, but these things happen, right? These things happen. So, you know, what do you do when the tidal wave washes over you, right? What do you do when you don't get the job What do you do when, you know, you get the cancer diagnosis? And this koan is saying, we practice Piquan. You know, we Zen people practice Piquan. This is our way of coping. This is our way of dealing with the world, you know. When everything fails, you know, this is how we handle things, you know. You sit down on the cushion and you straighten your back and you begin to work with the hara. You squeeze the breath out and you begin to call mu, and pretty soon, you know, your mind goes to this place that's blank. And, you know, if we have a lot of distractions, it's hard to get there. This is why it's good, you know, to do extra sitting. You know, you have to sit there and get still. You have to really get still. You know, you don't have to sit for 9 years, but you have to, maybe an hour isn't going to do it. And you sit down and your mind begins to get still and you begin to settle into this state, which we call samadhi. Now, there's actually many different kinds of samadhis, many different kinds of absorption states. So, you know, there's a samadhi of if you're watching tennis, you know, you can be totally absorbed. You can forget what time it is. You can forget who you are. You're just totally watching tennis, you know. There's a samadhi of tennis, even. If you like to jog, you know, you can get in the groove and you're just in the groove. Time disappears, that's samadhi of jogging. But there's a samadhi of emptiness, which we think is very, very important in Zen. We practice every day, you know, if you're really serious about Zen. You try to sit as often as you can, and ideally you sit every day. You face that wall every day, right? And this is a kind. This gives people a kind of grounding that I think nothing else does. You know, when everything is taken away from you, what then? You know, and everything is going to be taken away from you. That's the truth. You know, at the end of my mother's life, she didn't even know her own name. Right? You know, it's like you lose your memories. Finally, you're just breathing. You know, you're just awareness of breath at the end, you know. And this is the human condition. It's not a tragedy. It's how things really are. So, you know, finally, you know, economies collapse. I hope it doesn't. I hope the Pope is wrong. I hope he's wildly wrong, you know. People die. They get cancer. systems of thought fall apart very quickly and become passé, you know. But there is a way of grounding yourself, you know, which is deeper than ideas. It's deeper than ideas. And that is a mushin, this emptiness we face. You watch the breath. Eventually, if you just keep watching the breath, your mind is going to become very, very still. Very, very still. And at the end of your breath, there's a kind of space, like a little space. And then you start breathing again. You follow the breath out, and you get to this little space. And then you start breathing again. But you can begin to focus on that little space at the end of the breath. And you know, we Zen people think that's very liberating. That is a point where you begin to face your deeper mind, You know, the Zen view is that we live a conscious life, which is very shallow, and that we live this other life, which is an unconscious life. And one way to think about Zen is that what we're really doing is learning, we're learning how to get back into contact with our unconscious, with our deep unconscious. You know, modern people do live in a world of ideas. We live in a world of, lots of sensations. We live in a world that's very self-centered, you know, very self-centered. And it has to be that way, you know. We've constructed a reality that's all about the self, you know. But we lose touch with this deeper grounding. Lots of people, you know, are unable to get access to this, you know. You know, and it can be, you know, this lack of access can be confusing to us. You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday who said, he was talking about having feelings of guilt. But he didn't say feelings of guilt. He was confused about things. And he said, you know, I feel that I've done something wrong to this person, or I think that I've done something wrong. And finally he said, you know, I think I shouldn't feel guilty, but I feel guilty. And, you know, that was like a big breakthrough because, you know, intellectually he knew there was no reason to feel guilty, but he also knew that his feelings were making, you know, he had feelings of guilt. And he sort of got in touch with what he was really feeling. You know, his mind was saying, there's no problem here. But his feelings were saying, this is a real problem for me. And most of us live very far from our feelings. You know we're very far from being able to access how we really feel about things. You know, and this is a problem, right? You know, when I was taking my PhD exams, I was under so much stress, and I used to read the newspaper about the President Reagan. And I would get so mad, and I would go have coffee, and I would just sit there and talk about what a jerk Reagan was and what a bad man he was, and I would be so vehement. And, you know, I have to say, I think Reagan was a bad man, it's my personal feeling. But I wasn't really mad at Reagan, you know. I wasn't able to sort of access my feelings of, like, fear and feeling overwhelmed by the task and, you know, I had lots of emotional turmoil that I wasn't able to see clearly. You know, that's a dimension of having access to our unconscious, you know. But the unconscious is even deeper than our feelings. You know, the Zen unconscious is really this very deep processor, right? You know, which is something we access on the cushion, and that answers our questions or helps us to act in the world. You know, you can actually learn how to be a deeply intuitive person, you know, through Zazen. And, Zen psychology says, you know, that this unconscious is can be trusted, you know, And that if you access it, it can help you to get the bigger picture, you know. So the little mind has the little picture. The mind that thinks is really actually the small mind. It comes up with reasons and ideas. But, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you're struggling with something like cancer or personal tragedy, there's nothing anybody can say to you that's going to make you feel better. You know, but if you're working through it, if you can get into contact with this deeper mind, you know, you're sitting there facing that blankness with your misery or with your sense of loss or with your sense, you know, maybe you've been injured by somebody and you're coming back to this blankness, and you might think nothing is happening. You know, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you might have to do 50 sits or 20 sits. And you get off the cushion and you feel like, I am so happy to be alive. You know, life is so wonderful. You know, maybe 50 sits earlier, you know, you were ready to throw yourself off a cliff, or you felt that life was utterly awful, terrible place to be. You know, and 50 sits later, you suddenly have this tremendous sense of optimism and openness. It's like the whole world is unfolding and you're right at the front of it, you know. Now, what makes that difference, the Zen people would say, is your ability to get in contact with your deeper unconscious. You know, which is really like, from the Zen standpoint, it's like indestructible. Indestructible mind is like absolutely trustworthy. You know, humans don't trust. You know, we humans don't trust. You know, we don't. We think, and therefore we don't trust. You know, that goes with thinking, right? You know, getting in contact with your deeper mind is getting in contact with that part of yourself that actually feels deeply connected. deeply connected to things. You know, I was reading a psychologist, and he said, everything in your dream world, everything in your unconscious is an aspect of yourself. I actually think that's true. In this deep, big mind, everything is one life. It's all one life. You know, in the little mind, it's not all one life, right? We're hanging on by our teeth sometime, right? But when we get into this bigger mind, this is the unified mind in accord with the way, you know. It's like it has the panorama. It has the big view. It sees the wholeness of things, you know. And we can't get to it consciously. You know, you can't think, you can't use thoughts to get to it, because thoughts are what breaks the world into pieces. But when you get access to your deep mushin mind, you know, you sit there for 30 sits with your suffering, and finally, you know, on the 31st sit, you get up and you think, it is a wonderful thing to be alive. And all of that just falls away. And it's like this trust in life is restored. You know, this is, in my opinion, like the essence of Zen. You know, so Bodhidharma doesn't get down in the dumps because the Emperor of China didn't give him a job. You know, he goes up into the mountains and he starts doing zazen, and he sits for 9 years. And lo and behold, the three most capable people in China show up, right? This is the first person, and the first person is in agony because he lives in a small mind world. You know, he studied Sartre, he studied Derrida, and he has all of the usual problems. You know, he doesn't know how to ground himself, and he says, you know, my mind is on fire. You know, I can't find peace. I've lost my trust in life. My mind is on fire. You know, I could go east, I could go north, I could go south. And, you know, Derrida says this, Foucault says this. You know, I just don't know. You know, I ask my friends what to do, and I do what they say, but I don't feel any better. You know, what? My mind is on fire. And Bodhidharma says, show me your mind. You know, and what he really means is sit down on the cushion and try to find your mind, by, you know, through like meditative introspection. Now, you know, this man is a very unusual person, right? You know, if he were a typical person, he wouldn't know what Bodhidharma was talking about, and he'd say, you're a phony, goodbye, and he'd go back down the mountain. But this is a person of very deep experience and already like deep psychological insight, we could say. So he sits down on the cushion, or maybe not, maybe just stands there, but he looks inward at his own mind. He follows the breath to that blank place. And as soon as he gets to the end of his breath and he gets to that blankness, it's like a turbulent sea, and suddenly the waves stop churning and the wind stops blowing, and it's crystal clear. It's like glass, right? So he's in hell, and we've all been there. You know, we've all been in the hell of confusion and distrust. You know, gnawing distrust. You know, and Bodhidharma says, look at your own mind. Try to locate this mind. Second patriarch, looks in at his mind and sees that it's empty and blank. And at that moment, the waves just become calm and the ocean becomes placid. And it's like, there is no problem here. Right? There is no problem here. Bodhidharma sat facing a wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma. This is the last part of the koan. Bodhidharma is in the cave, and the second patriarch is outside trying to get admission to be Bodhidharma's student. And Bodhidharma is unresponsive, And the second patriarch keeps saying, look, look how worthy I am. I'm sitting in the snow. You know, for God's sake, you know, I'm in the snow. You know, I'm in the cold. I've walked up here. Come on, come on. Acknowledge me. Acknowledge me. Ratify me. Ratify me, right? Please make me, you know, ratify me. And Bodhidharma won't do it. And finally, Shinko cuts off his arm. And, you know, it's like, I'll make the ultimate sacrifice. In a way, this is like saying, you know, Father, Daddy, please see me. Father, please see me, you know. And he cuts off his arm. It's like, you must make me real by approving of what I've done. But Bodhidharma says, look, look, you know, that's not how we solve our problems. You know, don't look to others for ratification. You know, if you use the method I'm teaching, which is to look at your mind, look in your mind, and you get to this place that's blank and dark, and process in this way. And then, you know, the answer that comes to you isn't the answer you think I want you to give. You know, the Zen way of teaching is not to say, here's what you should do, here's what you should think. Teacher gives you a koan, and you have to process it by going into emptiness, and you come with your answer. You come with your... People think there's a right answer in Zen, but the right answer is going through the process. And if you go through the process, the answer that comes out of your unconscious is the right answer. So you're not looking for... And Bodhidharma says, you know, you didn't have to cut off your arm. Don't you understand? I want you to be a person who doesn't look to others for approval. See? So I hope... This is just a story. I doubt he really cut off his arm. But we all cut off our arm to be approved of by others, don't we? And it's kind of saying this is an inauthentic way to live. Yeah, this is not the way, this is not our way in Zen. You know, we don't cut off our arm to be approved of by others because that doesn't make us free. You know, the way to be free, the way to get in touch with who we really are is to sit on the cushion and go to that emptiness, that blankness, and then let the big mind, this larger self speak. You know, and you get your instructions. And if you follow those instructions, you know, you won't be unhappy because you're doing what your true nature told you to do. You know, as long as you're in harmony with that part of yourself, there's not going to be a problem. It's when we're not in harmony with that part of ourselves that we feel like our life is going off the rails, you know. You know, my grandfather, my Dharma grandfather, was a monk named Miyauchi Kanko, who lived in a place called Kameoka. His temple was in Kameoka in Japan. He had two robes. That's it. Those, you know, in my closet I have like 15 shirts, you know. Miyauchi Kanko had two shirts, basically, you know, two robes, winter and summer, right? And he slept on a tatami mat, you know, four by eight. That's his house, basically. And he had like a razor, you know, he had a toothbrush, a few other things, you know. And, you know, I never met him, but my teacher, Webb, said he was the most amazing person. You know, he's so happy, so happy. You know, it's possible to say, you know, what a terrible life. You know, he had nothing. You know, he, you know, slept on the ground, basically. You know, he didn't have a bed. He had two shirts. Very happy man, you know. So why was he happy? I think he was happy because he was doing what his true nature told him to do. You know, I met one other Zen teacher, and you know, he told me that his parents didn't want him to become a monk. They didn't want him to become a monk. They fought. His father was a doctor, and wanted him to be a doctor, and he wanted to be a monk from the time he was like 12. And he said, you know, my parents fought me and fought me about this, but I did it. And he said, you know, I took vows, and when I became a monk, he said, I was so happy to be a monk. You know, it doesn't have to be monk, right? It could be something. But he was acting out of this place. You know, he was acting out of this place this deeper self, this deeper mind. And he said, the minute it happened, you know, he said, I'm so happy to be a monk. You know, 60 years later, still a monk, you know, still happy about it.
Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, "The broken-toothed old Hindu," came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shisanro did not know four ideographs.
Mumon's verse, coming east, directly pointing to the blankness. You entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you.